Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us for episode 23 of the Talking Llamas podcast. On this episode, we talk about Beauty and the Beast, sort of the history behind it. We actually go fairly in-depth on the original story, and by that I mean like the original fairy tale. So if you're interested in that, that's something that we talk about quite a bit. But we also talk about the history of the making of the film and some of our favorite things about it and, you know, the people involved and what went into it. And, you know, go through the film a little bit as well. So we hope you enjoy listening to it as much as we enjoyed researching and talking about it. We'll also have some information on sort of our resources, both in the show notes and throughout this episode. So listen for those or just look in the show notes if you're at all interested. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can follow our Facebook page. It's just Talking Llamas Podcast. You can follow me and Thomas on Facebook or be our friends on Facebook. He's Thomas Nelson. I'm Robert Camozzi. You can find the show on Instagram at Talking Llamas Podcast is the handle. My handle on Instagram is at DaDisneyDad. That's just D-A Disney Dad. And leave us a review as always. Just leave us a review real quick if you got some time. Give us some feedback. Let us know what you like, what you don't like. Help shape the future of our show. Or if you don't have time for that or any real thoughts, you can always just give us a rating. That's really the best way to support the show, rate and review. All right, guys. Well, without any further ado, episode 23 of the Talking Llamas podcast. Hey guys, and welcome to the show. I am Robert Camozzi, joined here today by a very special guest. Thomas Nelson joins me here today.
Yeah, hey, here I am.
Yeah,
it's me.
How's it going, buddy?
Am I more special today than normal?
Yes.
Oh,
I can't place it, but there you have a certain glow about you today.
Well, isn't that nice?
Yes. Well, I don't...
Glow aside, what would you like to talk? Anything in the news? How about Rise of the Resistance?
Something we didn't talk about last week, yes, Rise of the Resistance. Have you observed any of the goings-on in... Because it's only opened on the...
One coast, Florida. Yes.
Yeah, Florida.
I haven't observed much. I only know that it's very popular, and some people are saying it's one of the better attractions to exist ever, which is big praise, especially from certain people.
Yeah, I'm interested. I watched the Imagineering story today, the most recent episode. I'm all caught up. Are you even...
No,
you're
I
a
couple
have episodes,
five and six to catch up on.
Yeah. They go pretty heavily, at least at the end, probably the last 10 to 12 minutes, on Galaxy's Edge. And they explain a lot about the Smuggler's Run. They go a lot in depth on that, but then they go into Rise of Resistance. They actually show a lot of it. I was kind of surprised they showed so much
like,
of it.
Like more than the sort of trailers they put out?
Yeah, for sure.
Because what I walked over to the TV real quick to ask you something, and I looked what was on it, and what was on it I'd seen in a trailer.
Yeah, no, they definitely gave some stuff away, which if you don't have a problem with that, I'd kind of just...
You know, that's what Oprah does. She just gives stuff away.
Yeah. You get a car, you get a car. In this case, you get a video of Rise of the Resistance you may or may not want. All sorts of things. Yeah, I was watching the episode. I wasn't going to stop it, so I was like, whatever.
So they're using this virtual queue thing at the park.
I don't know how that's going. It sounds like it's good, right?
It seems like it's a good system, and I guess. I don't know much about how it works, although I do wonder what it's going to be like in Disneyland. Because when they opened Galaxy's Edge here in Disneyland, they did not need... the virtual queue. They had it available, but they never needed it. It's from what I could tell. Maybe my first few days. But
yeah, I don't remember.
Actually, that was once it opened to the public. So there was that, I don't know, what was it, a month or two?
Yeah. Well, a month.
Of reservation time. And then after that, they had the virtual queue. And I don't think it was really necessary.
I think Florida actually used it just one day, like literally for the first day and then never again.
But this attraction is supposed to be really a big one.
Well, remember when that Hagrid ride opened in Orlando and I told you the wait times were like 10 hours and people are waiting in line physically. So I think that's the sort of thing they're trying to avoid. I guess it's good, but what if your arrival time is like 10 hours away or whatever and you...
Well, I don't think they would allow for that.
I don't know what the time is.
Neither do I.
How long do you want to be spending the day in Hollywood Studios is what I'm asking.
Well, I'm imagining, without knowing, that you could have, say, a 10-hour away. So maybe you get there in the morning. Maybe you have to be there. I don't know. However you log in and get in, sign up for the virtual queue, maybe you get an evening return time or whatever. I would imagine you could leave the park and come back. It would be silly for them to design something where that's not an option, keeping you in the park for the entire day. Now, a lot of people also don't have a park hopper. For some reason, I don't get that, but people do that, so they could be in the park all day.
Well, at Disneyland, it wouldn't be an issue because there's just more. I mean, I'd rather be in Disneyland than Hollywood Studios, and I don't think that's particularly controversial. But also, like, if you had a park hopper, you could just walk across the way to California Adventure. That's not an option necessarily at Disney World. So I'm wondering how that goes. If it's just a couple hours, though, there's plenty of things you could do in that time. You know, get something to eat or shop or walk around, whatever. So, I don't know. I think it's better than waiting in a 10-hour line, that's for sure.
Yeah.
No matter how good the attraction is. Now, it's going to be a while before you ride this.
I won't ride this until the fall, unless I come into some money and can go on a trip in between. So, basically, less than a year, just under a year from now.
Yeah.
But that's fine with me. I can wait. That's fine.
Yes. When you say the fall, you mean the fall of what exactly? The fall of... The government.
The fall of Rome.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah, we're going to go back in time.
Yeah.
And we're going to do that. Hey, speaking of time, going back in time, a number of episodes ago, we announced that we'd be doing a Tomorrowland episode. This is definitely a sidebar, but important. And we will be doing an episode where we reimagine Tomorrowland a little bit in our own image, or a lot bit, depending on how in-depth we can go into. But we actually have to postpone that for some unknown time. So we can really prepare for it, because it's actually incredibly difficult, believe it or not.
Yeah, it's very complicated.
I just wanted to say that and get it out there on the airwaves, if that's what we're using.
Are you bummed out that you are not going to ride this ride for like a year?
No. No.
I'm probably not going until June, but I'm not ruling out like a very, very short trip in March for Peyton's birthday. I was going to do March for sure, and then I've since decided to make it definitely June and then maybe March, but the March one would be just a couple of days. But it would be nice to get in there. I mean, Michaela's really twisting my arm to get there. Like, she wants to go like the weekend it opens. I can't imagine. It'd be just a nightmare.
I wouldn't see the point in that.
I don't know if she literally wants to, but she keeps saying like, we could just go for like the weekend. I think it's opening on like MLK weekend or something like that, though. Which, I mean, no thank you.
Well, yeah, if you're gonna have those extra days off for the locals. Yeah, I don't feel the need to have to go ride it. I mean, I can wait 10, 11 months. That's not an issue for me. It's not like I'm missing an entire Halloween season or something. I mean, the ride will still be there. I can go whenever I can go, and the ride will be there. It's not like I'm restricted to a certain amount of time during the year, and I've missed it.
I'm just very excited for it, I guess. And I personally don't want much of it spoiled. I actually don't think that episode spoiled much, because it's a lot of concept stuff before the ride's completed. It's not like they give you a ride through or something like that. It's mostly like digital renderings of what you're going to be seeing, but nothing that's reality. So I guess I just kind of want to have it as untainted as possible when I actually go on it. So for me, the sooner the better. But yeah, I mean, it's not the end of the world. Like you said, it's not like you're missing a full year in the parks or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ready for Christmas, Thomas?
No. I hate Christmas.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. But I am fine. I'm busier right now this time of year at work and I guess just around here. So it's harder to get in the mood. So I actually love Christmas. Let's get that out there.
Did the trip help you get in the mood for Christmas?
A little. Yeah. Movies help. When I watched a couple weeks ago, I watched Home Alone. And for me, that brings me back to my childhood. But I want to watch The Santa Claus.
Most of the ones that I like watching are on Disney Plus, or a lot of them, I should say.
I can think of three. Santa Claus, the two Home Alones. I guess Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yeah.
Although I consider that a multi-holiday film.
Well, and Noel Thomas.
Well, that's been a favorite of mine since the early 90s.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've heard actually that that was good, but you know, that was people on Facebook who were, I think, Disney apologists.
Yeah.
So well, they might like everything, like most things.
Yeah. Well.
And if you listen to our Frozen 2 review, you know we like very few things.
Yeah. Well, about that anyways. Well, Michaela watched it and said it was just sort of like your generic...
And that's like what corny. It seems like. But I kind of want to watch that. You know what? There's a Disney Channel original movie called The Ultimate Christmas Present from the early 2000s and late 90s,
yeah,
or whatever.
Is it an ultimate? Is it like a frisbee? So you can
I think it is. It's a weather machine that they have that they can, I think, make. I'm not going to dive into the plot right now.
Yeah, don't spoil it.
No, no, no.
We should one day, we should watch like over a week's time all of the Disney Channel original movies and then divvy them up in some way, or you know.
Yeah, okay.
That's
I mean that it would be fun to have a sort of a talking episode where we discuss them if they're worth it. Maybe we discuss all of our favorites.
Yeah.
In an episode. That could be fun.
The 13th year?
Yeah.
Do you remember that one?
I remember that one. I remember let's just save it for, cuz I think we should do an episode on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, we could do that.
But I was going to say other movies, not Disney, Jingle All the Way with Arnold Schwarzenegger. I like that one.
I haven't seen that one in years.
Also has Phil Hartman, yeah, rest in peace. He's a really, really great actor, actually. I enjoy him. National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
Yeah.
There's probably a couple more, too, that I'm really into.
There's actually some renditions of, like, I don't even, or whatever you would call them, but takes on Christmas classics using Disney characters. Like there's a Christmas Carol one where they use, you know, the Fab Five or whatever, you know, sort of those original Disney characters. And there's a Muppets one actually for the Christmas Carol too. So those are all on Disney Plus. Those are kind of fun. Mm. All right. Well, get ready. Christmas is almost here.
Yeah, a couple weeks. Week and a half? No, a couple. Yeah, week and a half.
Yeah.
A couple weeks and a half from now.
There's actually a Christmas episode... Or Christmas version, what would you call it? Like a sequel? I don't even know what you would call
it.
Well,
what are we talking about?
Well,
first?
That's what I was going to say. There is a Christmas themed short of Beauty and the Beast. And that's.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's what we're talking about today. So let's go ahead and on that, just get right into Beauty and the Beast. What about Beauty and the Beast stands out to you the most when you think
music.
About it?
Yeah,
music.
Yeah, it's definitely the music.
Yeah.
But you know what? One more thing. The artwork.
That's what I was... Yeah, I think that's a little bit underrated, actually, when I think about it in my head. Like, I undervalue that maybe more than I should.
Yeah. And for a while before I got Beauty and the Beast on a recent Blu-ray release, I think in 2016... before that, I had a DVD, and when I watched the DVD,
yeah,
it's not nearly the same as watching it in HD.
Yeah.
So, having watched it this week, it was really obvious the artwork was impressive.
Yeah, the artwork, I mean, just everything about it really is quite good. I actually, in watching this and sort of, just bumped my mic, so if you heard that, sorry. In watching this movie for... I guess this episode and kind of through the lens of trying to observe it, you know, knowing I was going to have to review it, I think that this might be objectively the best, if certainly one of the best, but to me it might be just objectively the best Disney movie. It just seems like it has everything, and I know that's like high praise, but
it's certainly in the top tier of the movies.
Yeah.
And that the reason I put it in a group rather than as a singular best is because obviously people's preferences are just different. And as much as you can be objective, I would say you're about 95% right.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Well, I haven't done an analysis of it, so I can't quite dive into it, but there's pretty much everything about it is spot on.
Yeah. It's well, and we both watched a documentary that you can actually find on Disney Plus. I don't know what it's called, but if you go to
Beyond Beauty.
Okay. So if you go, an easy way to find it, and maybe just searching it, but also if you go to Beauty and the Beast on Disney Plus and then you go down to the extras, there's a 53-minute extra, and that's it. And you can watch that. And it gave a lot of insight to sort of where the studio was at the time and actually the making of this film. Like, it was very brief, so I don't know if you caught it, but sort of the head of animation or whoever he was said that they originally started with this not being a musical.
I heard that, yeah.
Shocking. Just shocking.
Well, not shocking, given that they have yet... I think they were still in the 80s at that point. They had to be, I guess. And so they were just coming out of this slump in the studio. So I don't think they exactly knew what the heck they were doing. They knew what they had to run a business, but the entertaining side of it wasn't quite as developed as it had once been. So they kind of had to revamp that. And the music being included was... luckily, something that took it further and then furthered the Renaissance.
I guess it surprised me because, you know, Little Mermaid is very much a musical, so and that preceded this. So I expected that would...
Well, yeah, it preceded it in release date. But when the ideas were coming up, and so I don't know when they started working on Beauty and the Beast. They may have said it in that documentary, but I have to imagine that it was all sort of being talked about around the same time. And I think Don Hahn said at one point that in the beginning they were sort of working on this project, and Don Hahn is a producer on the film, and I still don't know what exactly he did, and I keep wondering that, but I hear his credits
I hear
are always
his name
like,
all the time.
Yeah, and the credits are always producer this and or executive producer that. I still don't know what he does. Maybe I'll ask him if I ever see him.
Yeah.
Well, I've seen him at the museum before.
Oh, okay.
A couple of times, I think, so... he's around, but anyway, he was saying that in the beginning it was sort of, well, we're making this film and we don't quite know when it's going to be released and it'll cost what it'll cost. And there was no deadline or whatever in the beginning. So I think that Little Mermaid being a musical and Beauty and the Beast being a musical, I mean, it just, I don't know. One had to happen for the other one to also sort of happen. But initially it was just an idea that not to have the music.
So the original group working on this project spent about 6 months on it, and then they looked at, you know, sort of the early renderings and decided to basically they had to throw the whole movie out and start over, which apparently happens. But
They said that about someone in that documentary said about Pinocchio.
Pinocchio, yeah, they did the same. Walt did the same thing with Pinocchio.
Yeah, so there was a legacy of that happening, and not even just in the Walt Disney Studios, but across all filmmaking, I think. Although usually with the film, you have a script written out. And I think in this one, they didn't have as much of a script.
Yeah.
As a story. Or maybe that was in Walt's time. But anyway.
Well, that's when Howard Ashman and Alan Menken get involved. And that's who we sort of, I mean, that's who we can credit for all this, the wonderful music that's in this movie. I mean, the music is all so great. You've been listening, what was it, you just told me this, so you were listening to...
There's an album, I have subscribed to Apple Music so I can just listen to it, but it's on YouTube also. There's a series of CD releases that Walt Disney Records, I believe, released called, I think, the Legacy Collection. And so you can get a Disneyland version and then different films too, most films. And they typically include for the films, like in this case... demos of the songs that we hear. So on Beauty and the Beast's Legacy Collection CD, that album, which again is on YouTube, you get the demos for several of the songs, which are Howard Ashman and Alan Menken and a few other background people in some of the songs, performing them very roughly, but still the music is there. And it's really cool to hear because you can hear the creators of the music performing it. And Howard Ashman and Alan Menken, they can both sing. And then I think Howard Ashman... and Alan Menken, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, they both can do some emotive voice work, so they can use emotion in their voice to portray the character in the moment, in the song. So during Gaston, I think Alan Menken plays LeFou. They switch back and forth between the two of them, but the point is they can get into character. It's really fun to hear, and it's not something you get to experience very frequently.
Yeah, so obviously that's a huge turn for this film because, like you said, the music's such a big part of it. I wonder, I mean, it was nominated for best what was it? Best Song.
Did you write this down?
Yeah, I have it.
A lot of nominations.
So, well, I mean, we just go over it. It was nominated for Best Picture, Achievement in Sound, and then it was also Achievement in Music for its original score, and then separately, Achievement in Music for three separate songs, Beauty and the Beast, Belle, and Be Our Guest. So, I mean, that's just, the music is obviously such a huge part of it.
Yeah.
And one of the directors, I don't know which one of them it was, but he was saying how the music in this film and the way he looked at it was it allows you to say things that you wouldn't normally be able to just say in dialogue, but through song, which I thought was interesting.
He said no self-respecting actor would say these things.
Yeah, which was funny, yeah.
And I think that's a pretty good point.
Yeah, because it's, you know, they can be, I don't know if corny is the word, but sort of, you know, cliche maybe is a better way of putting it, that they just aren't things that you would verbalize normally, but you can put them in a song and people will listen to it. And
well, let's take, well, what's a good song like that? Maybe like Gaston or something like that?
Yeah, that's a good one. Even Beauty and the Beast, though, I think is that way a little bit, where it's just like, it's very, it is sort of cliche and boiled down and... I don't know. I think there's a little bit of that in a lot of these songs.
Well, what do you mean by cliche and boiled down in that song? Because I'm trying to say something, but maybe you can help me get there.
Well, I guess what
or
I would...
not go there.
Like, Beauty and the Beast in this film is sort of a... I don't know if it's a metaphor or a... And the way I'm looking at it is almost like a low-resolution explanation of the whole film. Saying it in the song allows you to sort of convey that without saying it out loud, right? Because does that make sense?
Maybe yes. Not. Yeah.
Because saying it out loud would be, I don't know, self-referential, and that's not what you want. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
Okay, making sure that I'm making a little sense. But Gaston is a caricature, so that's a whole nother thing.
Well, I was just thinking self-referential. I agree. I don't like that in films too much. And I feel like that's something that, jumping back a couple weeks, I think Frozen 2 was a little too self-referential. But
anyway. We have to reel you in on that.
Yeah, yeah.
At Disneyland several times, Thomas was like, I have to stop talking about Frozen 2 because he just...
Oh, yeah. I dug my heels into my 6 out of 10.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Anyway, but they do. I was going to say with Gaston, that song, that it shows through the song his character, but you wouldn't just start saying everything like that out in public. So it's a way to give the audience information about the character.
Quick. All you need to know.
And entertainingly.
Yeah.
If that's a word. It's very entertaining, that song. I mean, you probably know all the words to it.
Yeah. Oh,
and
absolutely.
I probably know most of the words to it. And that's what I like about all these songs, is they're really... you can sing along to them, but they also get the job done. Like, you learn so much about Belle from that opening number.
Yeah, I think everything, all these songs, maybe Belle least of all, but all of them in some way are kind of fun to, like, you know, act out when you're in the car or just listening to them, and you can sort of sing along and act out the different parts because there's, like, so many unique voices and that sort of thing. In that documentary, they had... I don't know if the voice for Gaston and the singing voice are the same. I'd imagine they are.
Yes.
Yeah, the guy who plays Gaston side by side singing his part, and then, you know, on the side is the animated character. I love seeing that sort of thing. It's like, it's so cool to see the person performing it as it's, you know, being made. And I don't know. I just have to imagine that would be a lot of fun for them too.
Well, that's something that was brought up in that documentary, and it seems like we're reviewing the documentary a lot too, but that's a large source of this discussion, the information for it. But they were saying that they like, number one, for that movie, they really wanted to go out and get people from the theater world, from, say, Broadway.
I think that was Howard Ashman's sort of, that was his, like...
genius call.
Well, and just sort of a requirement for him in this
film. He was really pushing for it. But then they were also saying about the time that they had... the gentleman voicing Gaston on screen, they were saying that they want the people, the voice actors were, they wanted them to perform as they were voicing, like really perform it. And that's something a theater person, actor could, who's well versed in actual theater, is more likely to be able to do naturally than, say, a celebrity.
Well, and there's no question that the Gaston character does that. I mean, there's just, you know, there's several times where he really gets into it. So
maybe we should have a discussion sometime about using theater actors versus celebrity actors for voiceovers. Because, like, it worked with Robin Williams because he's such a unique personality. He can just do it on the spot.
He can also, he's not like, I wouldn't call him a great singer, but he can...
He can get the job done.
Yeah, he can, with it, using his voice, he was able to, I don't know, he had such a vocal range, I guess. Not for singing necessarily, but he was able to do all sorts of voices and things that it just worked. He didn't need to, like, it didn't need to sound, what's the word, like a beautiful song, but it worked. But Robin Williams is a once-in-a-lifetime person. Like, you don't see many people like that.
And I only mention this because the trend is definitely, let's get celebrities, big names for voice work. But we can table that discussion for another time and stick to Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, it's like you... I guess it, but like The Rock, for example, it worked with him. I mean, he's a big name, but I kind of liked his work. And
but he's another unique character. Like, he can, I imagine him getting into character easily, being very expressive, and when not all voice actors are that way, or if they are, they don't have a lot of acting experience necessarily. But again, let's get off this. And
what did you think about them debuting this sort of at the New York Film Festival, but like not even close to done? Like
a lot of pencil drawings.
Yeah. I thought that was kind of cool, but so for those who don't know, which would be most of you, I would assume, it's when they debuted this film, they brought it to the New York Film Festival, and they didn't have it done. It was like a lot of pencil sketches, really rough stuff. It seemed like all the voices were there and the music, but it was a lot of, you know, at certain times the Beast would look like a bush almost. It was like it didn't look, it was just wasn't complete.
Yeah.
But apparently people were just like breaking out in applause. Like after Belle, they broke out in applause. After Be Our Guest, they broke out in applause. And I think that speaks to, you know, you're sort of seeing, in the way they described it in the documentary was, you're seeing the way the magic is done or whatever. You know, it's like they're showing you how the magic is, trick is done, and they're still really appreciating it for what it is. And that's, you know, that's, I guess the studio sort of knew they had something on their hands at this point, but the people working on the film were really nervous. And
well, I think the music really carried that for the audience in that moment.
Yeah.
And even if it was just the demos that I heard, it would still pass to me, and it would be really good. Because those sounded really well done.
I heard Alan Menken one time, and I'm sure you've heard this too. I don't know if you remember. It was on one of those things where he's playing the piano and there's other people in the room. I don't know which one it is, but he says that when they originally made...
And we're not talking about a concert.
No, it's just like a...
It's usually like a special video.
Yeah, that goes on with one of these movie re-releases.
Well, it could be on Blu-rays. Sometimes they're just... There might be a couple actually that are special just on YouTube. But yeah, he'll do this thing where he sort of performs songs either himself or with people who sing with him as he plays piano.
I think it's actually the one attached to this film. It's another extra you can watch on Disney Plus. He says that when they conceived of Belle, I think it was Howard Ashman who was like, I don't even want to send this in. It's too long. So, because it is a long song.
Yeah.
And he was just like, I'm embarrassed. Like, I don't want to send it in because it's so long. And yeah, whatever. And they loved it. They were like, oh, this is like, there's a lot of character built into that song.
The thing is, with that song, a lot of times Alan Menken will say, you know, there's this, what, like 7.5 minute opening number. But that also includes like the prologue sort of music too, so it's still, though, it's like a 5 minute song.
Yeah, well, and
just Belle.
But it doesn't tell you just everything you need to know about Belle. It tells you about the town, and then you learn a little bit about Gaston. You learn more about him after that when he kind of meets Belle and or, you know, runs into her and speaks to her and stuff. But you get a general idea of how he's viewed. So I think you get a lot of like a big information download in that 5.5 minutes. And
that's audibly, but also visually you do too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you get an idea visually of everything that's being said, but there's also, I saw some video where it was said that Belle is wearing blue, and she's the only person wearing blue in that opening scene.
Yeah.
Supposed to signify that she's good or different. Anyway. And that song really definitely shows how the town is sort of stuck in this particular way of living, the provincial life.
Yeah.
and that Belle is singing about these other desires she has, and we see how she's different, and the people in the town know that she's different. And of course, in order to love a beast,
how can anyone learn to love a beast? You know? Yes. What do you think about like that song and something there? And we've talked about this before, where they intertwine, where their choruses have that same sort of melody with different words to them. Do you remember this?
You said it on one of our earlier podcasts, and I didn't remember, but then we checked it, and you're right.
Yeah,
there's something I forget. There's something there.
Well, yeah, no, she says, she basically, there's a Prince Charming sort of overlap in both songs, where she says, in something there, she says he's no Prince Charming, and in Belle, she says something like, this is where she meets Prince Charming. And there's that overlap, and different words surround Prince Charming, but it's the same melody.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And it's just genius and fascinating when you notice that. And in Belle, when she says, this is where she meets Prince Charming, but she won't find out.
Well, why it's genius, if it's not obvious to people, is that it's a callback to her dreams and then now her
reality,
soon to be reality,
and she doesn't even really realize it, because in Belle she says, "Here's where she meets Prince Charming, but she won't find out until chapter 3," and that's sort of her telling her future of like when she meets the Beast, she doesn't realize,
and that's in Act 3.
Yeah, well,
movies are broken up into 3 acts, basically, right?
I'm not an expert on this.
Neither am I, but that sounds right.
Nikita can answer for us later.
You all know who Nikita is by now.
Yeah. We've talked about him in bits and pieces enough that you can form a picture in your mind.
Yeah, anyway. personal friend, so no one should know.
But he knows about the film industry. I'm sure he'll
text me immediately. What do you have? You have, yeah, there are 3 acts.
The point is...
And then it's in the end of the film when they have the ballroom scene.
Yeah.
And obviously when they have the kiss and everyone is brought back to their normal human form.
Yeah.
That's Act 3. And that's when it's all realized.
So she's sort of reading her future or you know,
she's
explaining her future without knowing
it. She's sending a call out into the universe.
Yeah.
Sort of like Geppetto does when he wishes upon a star.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of saying it.
Yes, and then eventually the wish does come true through their own actions in the world. Now, that's basically what happens.
Well, that's what she's aiming at, right? That's the whole idea, just how Geppetto's aiming at Pinocchio becoming a real boy. And so her path leads her down that. And there's this weird, you know, you go into a whole bunch of philosophical or psychological things, but she's got to go into that. And when you go into that castle, it's like really dark. I noticed this when I watched it the first time, how dark the castle is. And when the Beast is like explained her things to her, there's like this echo that kind of goes throughout the castle. And it's just this sort of very, I don't know how you explain it, but this understated, dark place, whereas the town was very bright and vibrant. And even though she didn't love it there, it was, you know, a safe, homely place. And then she goes, yeah. And then she goes into this this
absolutely
forest.
Uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's something that's in the original story is discomfort.
Yeah.
In original story, I mean, like written hundreds of years ago.
Yes.
But that's a really interesting observation.
Yeah. So she goes into that and then eventually, you know, she's not realizing it at the time, but she eventually comes out of it where she wanted to be. She had to go through all of that difficult stuff to get there. What do you think about, we talked a little bit when we were playing this episode about the idea of Walt trying to do this in the past or having the idea of doing this in the past, and they sort of touch on that in the documentary where it was just, I don't know how much of this is actually why Walt didn't end up doing it, but it's sort of, the original story is difficult to translate because it's a darker story.
It's not that dark. I mean, it's dark, but not all that much more than, like they even said in the documentary, they played it down. Like I read it, it's just not that interesting to put on a screen. So they have to sort of put all these other elements into it. Like Gaston's not even, he's sort of like a representation of Belle had, she had 3 sisters and 3 brothers, or 6 of each in some versions.
Yeah.
But like he could be the version like the symbol for them in the story. But
okay,
basically they put a lot of different stuff into this one. So they had to make it work, and they did. I feel like Walt Disney could have done it, but he, as time went on, like especially in the 50s, Disneyland, the TV show, possibly Disney World, like we're getting into, he's just too busy to be focusing on creating these films in the way that he was. So
yeah,
well, I think that's probably a large reason why they didn't actually end up doing it.
It ended up working out, obviously, in this film. I mean, he also had ideas for Little Mermaid and that sort of thing. So it's interesting to see them eventually being made
And made well.
Yeah,
extremely well. What's interesting is in terms of making it well, at the end of that documentary, they talked about having essentially the A-team all together.
Yeah.
And how after that film, maybe it was Katzenberg, somebody at the studio said, hey, we're going to put out two movies a year. So that team
that was him
got split up. So I wonder if after that, if that's sort of like the putting, sort of like planting the seeds for a diluted product. I mean, we got some really good stuff after that.
A lot of really good
Aladdin
stuff.
Aladdin was already in the works. I mean, Howard Ashman, even though he died in the making of Beauty and the Beast, he worked on some of Aladdin's songs. So he was involved in that. That came out later. And then obviously we know the rest of the 90s was really good. But these days, I wonder if the A-team is even further diluted, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe. Just a thought.
Yeah, I don't know. I had that same thought, but then I kind of dispelled it because of all the really quality films that came into making directly after that. It was like Lion King and Aladdin, and it's like, well.
Well, and I just thought, if those are so successful, then it might make someone like Katzenberg say, hey, let's put out three movies.
Yeah.
Or, you know what I'm saying? And in that way, spread out the talent.
Yeah.
Or take on more people who aren't quite as good, but they'll definitely get the job done and make some money. Emphasizing a little bit more of the business side of show business.
Go ahead. You have anything else?
Well, that's something that they talked about. They said in the documentary was, you know, they're balancing the show business thing, working on the show, working on the business.
Yeah. It's equal parts. It's show and business. It's never one or the other. Yeah, it's interesting. I thought that was interesting as well. What did you think about the idea? Because I think it was Howard Ashman who was trying to do this, make this sort of, this movie was about the Beast. Is that how you view this film while you're watching it? It's more of the Beast's hero's journey.
Well, they said that Howard noticed, that he observed that the biggest transformation occurred within the Beast.
Yeah.
And so that was therefore an indication that it's his story. And I think that's right.
Yeah, I do too.
I don't necessarily think about it a whole lot, but when that point is made, I can't disagree with it.
Yeah. I think it's, I'm just wondering, because I feel like a lot of people sort of view this movie through Belle's eyes or through her lens, so to speak. So that was an interesting.
Well, and that's she's the person we follow.
Yeah.
So that makes sense. But ultimately, it's about loving the thing that he couldn't do, which turned him into a beast. She is able to do to him.
Yeah.
With him. So, you know, love and all that.
Yes. Well, it's the greatest love story of all time, as they said in the documentary.
They did?
Yeah, they said that. I don't totally disagree.
Oh, I remember that now, because what came to mind was, isn't that something they say about Romeo and Juliet?
Yeah, but come on.
They should do Romeo and Juliet, Disney style.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, but...
Well, I just... Do you have a favorite character from this film? I have a guess of who it would be, but...
What's your guess?
Well, mine's Gaston. That's my favorite character.
Yeah, that's a pretty good guess for me. I mean, you just said your favorite.
You didn't guess mine. I'm guessing that yours is Gaston, because to me, Gaston's so my favorite character. I mean, the Beast is great too, but
no, he's not that great.
Well, I enjoy the journey he goes on. I suppose.
I'm going to take the servants as a group.
You do this.
I know, but I wouldn't do that with. I'm not gonna lump Belle with Maurice with the horse. What's the horse's name?
Does the horse have? Oh my gosh! What is his name? Well, it'll keep talking.
But I'm not. I group them together because they work as a team. They're a team of servants, and so the team is who I'm after. In that sense, I like Belle, but Maybe Belle. I don't personally identify with her in the same way that I might with, I don't know, with other characters.
Yeah, no, I think it's Gaston. It's, I think that horse's
name. You think my favorite's Gaston? I love the moment when there's the.
Yeah, yeah, the I know where you're going with this.
I'm not
going
to do it.
Oh, man.
Because I'm not feeling it right now. But where he says, what did he say?
He says, oh, that is despicable.
I love it.
yeah, that's truly great. It makes me laugh every time.
That voice is amazing. Again, yeah, so that I love that moment. That character is pretty awful, so he's not my favorite. But
Maurice is harmless.
Crazy old Maurice.
Yeah. Mm. The horse's name is Philippe, and the reason that's important is there's a moment in the movie that also always makes me laugh where the horse is trying to go in a... Philippe is trying to go in a certain direction, and Belle's father is, like, not letting him go that way because he wants to go down this... He's lost, and he goes down this, like, dark pathway, and the horse is, like, not having it, but he forces the horse to go that way. And then, literally, he's like, no, we're going this way, Philippe, basically. And then, not, like, 2 seconds later... He's like, where have you taken us, Philippe? Like, blaming the horse for taking him the wrong way. I think that's always hilarious. Yeah, Maurice.
Well, in the original story, anyway, it was supposed to be that, you know, what, there are a couple versions, I guess, but it was supposed to be that the father goes through the forest, gets lost in the storm because the snow covers the trails. And so the horse would get lost, too. So at that point, it would be the horse leading him. I don't know, but anyway, it's... I guess he would still have the reins.
Is this a Grimm's tale that you read?
No, it's not a Grimm's tale.
I was wondering if it was, yeah.
No? It's a product of France.
Oh, okay. That's true.
I think even as early as maybe the late 1600s. Certainly one version dates back to the 18th century, the 1700s sometime. Yeah, it's an interesting story to read. Not that great, but not bad either. Because a lot of the elements we do have are there. I mean, she notices when she has to choose to be... See, in the story, she has to choose to be taken prisoner. But that's explicitly stated from the Beast to Maurice, the father.
Wait, so what does he say?
So what happens is that he...
This is in the original story.
Yeah, so what happens is in the original story, Belle has... Let's just take one version. Three sisters, three brothers of her father... the mother, I guess, is she has passed, or she's not present anyway. And so the father has an opportunity as a merchant to go in, I think, to port somewhere. And there's a ship, and he has an opportunity, some business opportunity. And so when he's going, because he expects to have riches, his daughters make requests for, bring me back this. And they're very vain, two of the sisters. Beauty is the third sister. And she says, well, I don't need anything. You know, something like that, because she's sort of pure-hearted, and the sisters sort of scold her for it, you know, because they're very snooty. But so to appease them, she just says, okay, why don't you bring me back a rose? Because we don't get those where we live.
Something we see in the live-action version, actually.
Yes. And so on his journey, after he's unable to acquire the riches for the other sisters, he gets lost and all that, and then he eventually, after... Well, let's take it to the castle. He gets to the castle, puts Philippe, the horse, not named Philippe in the story, but he puts the horse at the stable. He goes into the castle, and there's, I think, a fire going, and there's food available somehow, and he's able to sleep and sleeps in real late the next morning and wakes up, and there's more food, and he decides, okay, I'm going to leave now. And so he sets off on his way, but on his way, he sees a rose in the garden and remembers Belle. And so he takes it, and then almost immediately... The Beast appears and says, you would steal from me after all that I've given you, all the hospitality I've shown you. And so there's the deal comes that, okay, well, if I'm not going to kill you, because the father tells the Beast that this is just for my daughter, you know, this and that, the whole story about the business deal gone wrong and all that. He says, well, okay, you are allowed to live if you can convince one of your daughters to take your place, to come here. But they have to do it willingly. And so that's when Beauty says that she can't possibly stand to see her father perish, and she would rather take his place. And that's something we see in the film. And I can't remember why I started talking about this.
I just was interested in knowing kind of how they translated it. And it's interesting, you would, there's actually some aspects there from the live action version. Like he goes, yeah. He goes into, which I didn't know, he goes into the house and is able to sort of want, like, leave.
Yeah.
In the live action version, he leaves and then he takes a flower from the garden, and that's when the beast arrives.
It's interesting.
The story.
The live action one tried to tell, it seems like they tried to tell a story more in line with what was actually written.
Or they tried to add it, you know, and make it part of the film.
Yeah, and in the documentary, they mentioned that technology was sort of a limiting factor. So that might have been why it's a harder story to tell technologically. But then now that technology has advanced and they recently did this film, I think that's why they wanted to try and redo it. But I personally don't think they should have.
Yeah,
because the movie we're actually talking about, the 1991 version, is definitely better than live action.
It's amazing.
And as you said, it might be the best one they made.
I think it's actually, I mean, just taking away favorites, I think it is just objectively the best. Like,
yes.
It's so well. Is there anything about it that you could say, oh, they could have done this differently? I mean, everything about it is just A+ to me.
Yeah. Well, I'm gonna carry on because I took the original story to the castle.
Yeah.
And Belle taking over her father's spot. And so just to sort of get an idea of how Belle is, or Beauty, they call her Beauty in the story, how she is in the earlier stories. She gets there and she's obviously repulsed by his appearance because he's a beastly figure. But the whole time the beast almost immediately actually requests that she marry him, because that makes sense for the time period. I think that was more frequent, like to have marriage proposals or even betrothals.
Well, also you betrothed.
Yeah.
Intended. Anyways.
You two are going to be married.
Yes. If Zazu had just showed up, this would have all been remedied fairly quickly.
Well, it's in France, and frankly, that's the reason why not.
That's a long travel, yeah.
But so she denies it. But all the while that she's living there, because she gets there and she assumes she'll be like eaten or something within the first night or whatever, because that's, I mean, there's a lot of fear involved in her part of the story. And he is a beast, so you can't assume that he's necessarily good. And so she thinks this beast is going to maybe eat her or kill her for sure, because that was the threat laid against her father.
What is her father doing letting her go? I don't understand.
I think that her insistence was so strong that he didn't refuse, and I can't quite recall.
Fair enough. Go ahead.
But it wasn't the most important. And so anyway, she learns that she's allowed to stay. And he eventually says, you can stay here, or something like this, that you can stay here, maybe not forever. I don't know when he said, but so over time, she saw who was inside the beast, that he was actually really kind. But she couldn't marry him because of, she was so put off by his demeanor and his appearance.
So vain or shallow.
I think he was a towering figure, very loud. Certainly loud.
Yeah.
So she was, in that I mentioned discomfort earlier, she was made very uneasy by him. So she couldn't marry someone like that, surely.
Yeah.
But
well, I was kidding. I mean.
Well, I know, but it does seem that way.
He's not even human.
Yeah. Well, anyway.
yes.
And so she, what are you laughing at, bud?
I don't know.
Okay. So she, what did she do? She denies a marriage proposal. She goes on, has multiple interactions with him. He, I think, continues to propose every now and then, just checking, like gauging where she's at. And
did he ever propose at a baseball game?
No.
That's always embarrassing.
They don't play baseball in France.
Yeah.
And again, that's the only reason why not.
Go ahead.
But eventually, she misses her father. She requests, can I see my father? I really miss him and all that, because she did not expect to be living this long. And so he actually lets her go back home. And she goes back home. I guess that happens in the film, right?
Under different circumstances.
Yes. She lets him go back home. And he said, in one story I read, it was like a week or something. If you're not back in a week, forget the time period. If you're not back by a certain time period, it's not like she'd be punished, but he would suffer. Like he would... So anyway, she goes, and the father is surprised and all that jazz that she's back. And then she eventually goes back to the castle, and the beast is laying in the, like in the garden, because he's so heartbroken that he is basically, I think he stopped eating. I could have just added that in there. But I'm trying to justify why he's about dead on the ground.
Okay, so he's...
Anyway, Belle then, I think this is where I kind of forget my memory, actually, but at that point, that's sort of a turning point for beauty.
She realizes in that moment, oh no.
Well, I think there are some words exchanged, actually. I think she expresses something to him as he's lying on the ground.
I'm sorry that we're laughing, but it's so odd that these stories are kind of archaic, so it's funny.
When I'm
giving out
some details, it would make it a little bit more sincere. But anyway, he's awakened from being unconscious. But it's actually a pretty sort of sweet and genuine interaction, and that's when you get to see beauty and how she loves the beast, and there's a transformative element going on there. And there's actually a fair amount of magic that involves, I think, sort of instantaneous, like, time travel. So, like, I think the father appears almost immediately. I forget why. Maybe some celebratory thing. This is where I forget, but yeah. So there is a moment where in the actual film that we were talking about, the beast falls on the ground. Right.
Yeah, and it makes sense because he gets, you know, Gaston.
And I can't remember if the reason, maybe he was on the ground because of the spell. I can't remember if that was still in the written.
Is it in the original story? Is there sort of this time frame where he has to?
That doesn't ring any bells.
Yeah, I was wondering if maybe that time was coming and he was going to die, or something.
I don't think so, but that actually is a pretty good thing to put into the film.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
Well, putting it, I actually think that putting a time limit on this where, like, we're running out of time here, guys. I think when I was watching it recently here to prepare for this, that's a very compelling thing. And that's something we've talked about with other films. We're not going to mention which films we're talking because we've promised ourselves we wouldn't, but putting a time limit on these things gives you a sense of urgency that's sort of required for you, for the movie to have stakes.
Well, and not only the sense of urgency, but the knowing the stakes, how am I going to act in this moment? And so when he sacrifices his relationship with Belle to allow her to go back to her father and try to save him.
This is in the film, by the way, we're talking about.
That is, that's more impactful than just in the written story, sort of letting her go back because he's nice,
yeah,
or he's kind-hearted. This is, he's kind-hearted and nice, but he also loves her enough to let her go.
Well, and sacrifice becoming human again.
Yes,
and
human again.
Yeah. So, yeah, and I think that putting, what's also compelling about this film is putting that time limit on it, but also, like, I know it's like exactly, he has 11 years or whatever it is, 10 years, he has some time limit. I don't even know if
he has to be 21 years old.
Yeah.
I don't know how old he is in the...
But the point is, the rose is the indication of how much time he has left.
It's the hourglass.
But what's interesting, it's not an hourglass, and it's not a clock, it's not some countdown. It's sort of like, we don't really know how much time we have, like, at least the audience doesn't. It's like, how much time do we have? Time is running out. They're dancing right now. He's about to profess his love to her. Does he have 3 minutes? Does he have 3 days? And then he tells her to go, and it's like, okay, how long until they all become stuck in this state permanently? And so that's, I think that that's actually a really nice added element to this film that gives it a certain stake, where when you're watching it, you really feel that. Even when, you know, Gaston and the townspeople show up, you're kind of like, not only are you nervous for the beasts and everything, but you're also like, they're running out of time. Like, there's not much time to get this figured out. And I think that that's something that is really interesting, and it's a good idea. And something they mentioned in the documentary too is establishing how the magic works and getting that so you understand it. And there's never a point, and admittedly, I've watched this movie since I was a kid, so it's hard to say, but I don't think figuring out how the magic works is confusing. I feel like they do a good job of establishing it very quickly.
Well, you know what is a great tool for that is having the narrator do it in the beginning for a couple of minutes. describing the setup for the situation we're in once the movie actually begins.
Yeah.
So we're getting the stage is being set, and then from that point we're watching what's happening. So we're being caught up to speed, and it's actually a really helpful storytelling device.
Yeah, that's helpful. But then like establishing that by the way, there's all these people that lived in the castle that are turned into these inanimate objects.
Animate objects.
Yeah, but they're moving.
Regularly, yeah, normally.
Yeah.
Under normal circumstances.
I also thought it was interesting, you know, kind of springing off the, you know, Lumiere and Cogsworth, how they used what items those characters were turned into to kind of shape the way their characters behave. So, like, Cogsworth is sort of like this, like, wants everything to be... He's a clock. He wants everything to be on time, or, you know, that's kind of his... He wants everything to work on schedule or work as it should. You know, Lumiere is sort of this fiery personality and that sort of thing. I thought that was interesting as well, how the main... Sort of those main characters of the people who live in the house were given personality based on the objects they were turned into. That was interesting. I think a really... Through and through...
How about Mrs. Potts?
Oh, she's fancy.
She likes. Is that what you take from?
No, I don't know. They said something about it.
Did?
Yeah, but I can't remember hers because I was...
Well, I'm guessing, and I am, this is my interpretation, is that she... Like, what is a teapot doing? It's distributing something to multiple... It can be to multiple people, but it's
something
very giving.
Something warm.
Warm, giving.
Yeah. She's like a motherly figure.
A space... that can be occupied, so she can take on, like, you can, yeah, motherly, but she can, like, take on your problems or something. Maybe that's a little bit of a stretch, but...
Yeah, you know, no, I get what you mean.
Warmth is a good one.
Yeah, she's a warm, loving person, is the idea. This movie, if you had to say one part, and the reason I ask you this question is because I have a part in this movie that when you... think of it, or when you sit down to watch it, there's a part that you definitely want to be paying attention during and absorbing. Is there a part in this film for you that takes that you really want to, and it doesn't have to be something that's like moving, it could be funny or anything.
Well, I want to see the moving moments more, because funny I can remember, and oftentimes remembering funny things is funnier than the actual thing sometimes. So I was thinking about the ballroom dancing scene. That's just, I mean, all that gold, it's really a beautiful piece of animation. And the song is amazing, of course. It's the titular track. So that's one that really stands out. I love the scenes with Belle in the landscape of where she lives. I like to see that visually. It's short, but I love to see that. And then most of the songs I want to be there for, but again, you can sort of hear it and not have to see it so much. How about you?
So during Beauty and the Beast, the song and the really that whole scene, but specifically, there's a point in the movie.
Ooh, you know what? I love something there too. Go on.
That's good. There's a point in that scene in the film where they're dancing together, and it's sort of, it's gone this certain way where you can tell she's more into him than he thought. And then she puts her head on his chest, and he like looks down like, what is happening? And then he looks, he like processes it, whips his head around with this big smile and looks at his friends. It's giving me chills just thinking about it right now. Looks at his friends, Lumiere and Cogsworth. And they're like, yeah, yeah. You like, you know, they're not saying anything, but they're like cheering him on.
Yeah.
And every time I see that, it almost makes me cry. It's like, I don't, just like the buildup to that moment where you see the beast has gone through this, you know, the final transformation isn't complete, but he's sort of gotten to the top of the mountain for him. Like this thing he can't believe is happening, you know, throughout the film, he's like, oh, why would she ever, you know, why would she ever love me? Look at me. I'm hideous. Look at her. He kind of is externalizing that in his behavior. And feeding into this, like, not only am I a horrible beast, but I'm also a bad person. And then when she puts her head on his chest, it all is like, wait a second, maybe I'm wrong. And he has this sort of realization, just thinking about it right now. I mean, I'm not going to cry, but I could feel like it's a very intense moment in that film.
You know, you can cry.
Yeah, no, but I'm not, I don't have to, but like, I'm just saying that if... almost, I've seen that movie countless times, and every time it almost makes me cry. Like, it's such an intense moment. And
Not what I think about.
I don't know why that.
But I'm going to look for that next time I watch it, which could be soon because it's such a good movie.
I actually want to rewatch it myself. Yeah. That's one thing when we prepare for these things, and we were talking about this before we went on mic, but when you prepare for these things, you get really into the movie and excited to watch it. I feel like I could watch it multiple times in just like a week, and that would be okay.
I think doing something with a purpose sort of deepens your relationship to the thing. So watching these films, Snow White, Emperor's New Groove, we've talked about, now Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
And next will be, I think, Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yes.
We have a purpose in watching these films, and that's to pay attention and learn and see what are they doing and what do we like and what do we appreciate about it, instead of casual viewing. Like, sometimes we'll watch things and we'll be talking about other things during them.
Yeah.
So I think having a purpose in what you're doing, that's sort of like if you have, and you're in school and you're doing math, but it's actually applied to something you need to do. Maybe you're not in school, but you're still doing math and you need to actually create something. All of a sudden, it's way more interesting.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, what we're experiencing.
Having a purpose behind something.
Yes.
Something you're working towards, yeah.
Well, I think it forces you to focus on it more than you might when you just turn it on for fun.
I saw something interesting, and I haven't confirmed it actually, but the smoke, there's smoke when the beast is making his transformation. And that is apparently actual smoke. I don't know how they work that into the film exactly, or how that works, but the smoke when he's doing his transformation
is
real smoke.
That's actually some archival footage of Walt Disney's smoke. You know, he smokes cigarettes.
Yeah.
So they took him out and they just kept the smoke. And yeah. That was the legacy. It's in Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah. No, but it really is supposed to be smoke.
Yeah, I heard that that was a joke. I have to say sometimes when things are jokes, because you know, but yeah. I heard that they were trying to work in some computer animation into this one. I don't have much information on that, but I know it was
difficult. If you see in the ballroom scene, when they leave the ballroom, the door, it looks like it's computer animated. It does not appear to be hand-drawn animation.
Okay.
So observe that next time. Maybe we should watch the ballroom scene after this. It's not going to help anyone, but it might be interesting for you to see a couple things that we've just discussed.
Well,
but
listeners can turn it on too, especially if you have Disney Plus.
Yeah, so the back, that whole wall does not appear to be, or that door, the glass door that opens up when they walk out to the patio or whatever, the balcony, that appears to be computer animated. I don't know. The smoke, I observed it this time, and I usually don't pay attention to the smoke because I'm watching the beast, you know, kind of go up. But it does not appear to be animation of any kind. It does appear to be real smoke, which is interesting because I've never noticed it before. That it doesn't stand
out. Where did you
hear
that?
I saw it as a fact that somebody who posts Disney facts, and that's all they do on Instagram. I hadn't confirmed it, but when I watched it today, it did appear to be the case.
Okay. Look for that for sure.
So take that with a grain of salt. I should probably credit the person.
Take that with a puff of smoke.
Yeah. So that the point is that that's pretty interesting that they were able to. It just, like you said, the animation in this film. I mean, it's definitely like a step above to me. Like, because if we're comparing it to something, to me it's a step above, like something just before it, Little Mermaid. You know, I actually think the animation's quite a lot better. You know, because you say animation's good, and you're like, well, what does that really mean? But you can kind of compare those two films that just came out a couple years apart from each other, and the animation in this is far better than in Little Mermaid, to me. I'm not an expert, but...
Far better? I think that there might be an artistic style that's different, and therefore, I think this one is very visually appealing, Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, maybe.
Certainly, well, yeah, that's a large reason of why I enjoy it. I mean, just the village where she comes from to me is, one, reminds me of Fantasyland and Disneyland, sort of that European village style that you might actually find more in, say, Germany or something like that. But I like that visual. I like the landscape of where she is. As I mentioned, the castle is an amalgamation of different types of castles. That's really beautiful, too. So there's definitely a style of animation that is represented in the setting And it's definitely a setting in Little Mermaid, but all the colors are totally different, and the buildings are different styles. So yeah. I think whatever speaks to you. The animation is probably better, maybe a little cleaner.
That's a good word for it. It does feel cleaner.
And maybe that's a result
crisper,
of...
Crisper, maybe.
Yeah, crisp is a good one, too. Maybe that's a result of... Yeah, most of the movies in the 80s weren't that great, but I think they mentioned in the documentary that they were getting better.
They were warming up.
Refining their skills.
Yeah.
And so by the time you get to Beauty and the Beast, you really see the work that went into it. Because, again, they had the A-team on this one.
Yeah. Well, if you... this is not unique to this film, but in that documentary, they also talk about how they went to these places after they scrapped the first version that they spent 6 months on. They visited, these towns that had sort of an ancient feel to them. Ancient's not the word, but, in the older time. And they translated those to the film.
Well, they also went and looked at castles, too.
Castles, yeah, and they combined, like you said, different. But also, I forget the person who was the head animator for the Beast, but he went to
Glenn Keane.
Okay, I'm glad.
And I have a story about him.
He went to zoos and was like sketching all these different animals and then sort of combined them to make the Beast. Yeah. And you can see that if you observe the Beast, he has qualities of many different animals.
Buffalo, I think pig is in there.
Gorillas. Yeah. There's clearly a wolf style snout on him. I mean, so
I'm just gonna jump off because we're on the subject and it's directly in my experience. If Glenn Keane had an exhibit for a short time at the Walt Disney Family Museum where I volunteer, and he came on the opening night or maybe the night before opening day, and he gave a talk to sort of discuss the new exhibition, what he's been up to in the past at Disney and what he's up to now. But he had an animation table with a sort of a projector so we could watch him draw. And he was drawing the Beast to us, but he was describing, we have the ears here and they're sort of like a cow's ears, and we have these horns here which are sort of like this, and then this over here is like this animal, and he's drawing it as he's saying it. And what I noticed in the moment, as the Beast is coming alive on the page, you can see the Beast as he's describing it, is that the whole audience was completely silent, just in awe of this animator very quickly, but also very articulately describing it and drawing the Beast. So that was really cool to see the actual animator of the Beast in person doing this, and you could see the talent that was behind the team that put all this together. That's just one example of it. He's a Disney legend.
Yeah, did he work? He worked
heavily on Little Mermaid. He did Ariel. He did work on Pocahontas. He did a lot of work, actually. I have a story about Ariel, too, but I'll mention that in another episode.
It was good to hear from him on that documentary. He had a lot of good insights.
Yeah.
But I would encourage anyone to, of course, watch the film, but check out those extras, because they're really interesting. There's one with Alan Menken in it that I've already seen, so I didn't watch it in preparation for this episode, but also one that I would recommend checking out.
I'm really looking forward to, whenever it comes out on Disney Plus, a documentary called Howard, made by Don Hahn, produced probably, and so it's all about Howard Ashman. And now it was released in 2018 in film festivals, so maybe that's not a release, but that's a screening, multiple screenings, and it hasn't been out or available since. So it's supposed to be on Disney Plus. That's a fact, but I just don't know when. But I want to learn more about Howard Ashman, because he really seems like the real musical genius behind these, I guess, Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, and somewhat on Aladdin.
Yeah.
And Alan Menken, too, is another guy who's got a great feel for what's right.
Yeah.
Musically. And I want to see them together. I also want to learn more about Howard Ashman, because I think in the documentary they said that Howard was like Walt Disney in sort of the control over... not the control, but the grasp that he had on...
It seemed like he had a vision, and he really knew he really knew what he needed to make it happen and why it was right.
Yeah. Well, it was sort of had an innate sense of, okay, this will work, but also a little bit of an openness to let things sort of play out with other people. So he would let other people have input, But yeah. And so there'd be like a little workspace of ideas, and then he'd come back with the best thing.
There's a point in Belle where Belle's kind of walking, and Gaston's coming after her, and one of the people, I forget his name, who worked on the Beauty and the Beast said, "Well, there's not a lot happening in the music here."
I think that's Roger Allers.
Yeah, who worked on Lion King as well.
Maybe even Emperor's New Groove.
Yeah, I think he did work on Emperor's New Groove.
But anyway, yeah, there. Go on.
He and Howard was like Howard Ashman. Because the guy basically said, like, there's not a lot happening here. Gaston's after Belle, and it's just music. There's not a lot of words, and maybe we should have something. And he kind of said what they should do without giving, like, specifics. And Howard Ashman was like, okay, we'll play the song, and you just do it. And then he's like, yeah. Okay, I guess. And he does this thing where he's like, let me through. I'll take some grapes or something, all this stuff. You can hear it in the documentary, him reenacting it, not the actual in the moment, but. And Howard Ashman's like, okay, yeah, we'll do that. That's good.
Yeah.
It's like, he's able to collaborate.
He's flexible. Yeah, able to collaborate is better.
But also, had a clear vision and knew how to execute it and knew why it was.
And there's
what
little
needed to be done.
Minutia of things like inflection in the voice when singers are doing their songs. So, there's a number of examples in Little Mermaid. There's probably a few, but with what's her name, Paige O'Hara. In something there's a moment where she says, oh God, what is she? I don't want to give away the thing, but, it's a bit alarming.
Oh yeah.
That lyric where she comes up. I can't hit the note right. But, yeah. So Howard was, I think he had HIV.
Yes.
So he was also a sort of, he was dying in the middle of making this film. He didn't get to see it released or premiere.
Yeah.
But Alan Menken has a story. Maybe it was directly to him or to someone else that someone was on the phone with Howard and he sort of whispered in a very faint voice, about that moment, that lyric. He said, Streisand, Barbara Streisand.
Yeah.
And you can sort of, I don't even really know how I know that that's Barbara Streisand.
Yeah.
But it sounds... It's supposed to sound just like her in that moment. So that little moment, it also is a memorable spot in the song. When you hear it, you're like, oh, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking
about.
It's an important point. He did that with different things, too. So his vision was he was an expert in what he was doing.
Yeah. Well, very good. We'll look out for that documentary, and we'll let you guys know if we see it come across. Okay. Anything else on this film? I think we covered it pretty well.
Do you want to talk about the live-action version a little bit? I don't have it in my memory so much. So.
I mean, we talked about it. I think that it's I'm not a fan. And mostly because it's such a great movie before, and then they really just... One of my sisters, the older of the two, because the younger of the two listens to this podcast, I want to make sure she knows I'm not talking about her. The older of my two sisters... liked it so much and said that it was better than the original, which is just madness. I mean, that's not true. So
no, it
that's that's objectively false.
That's patently false.
Yes. Well, it's patently ridiculous and objectively false
in every way that it could be wrong. It is.
Yeah. I'm just not a fan of it. I think it doesn't work. I think that basically they...
How about the story? Forgetting about whether, say, songs work or...
I don't know.
Characters
we could really dive into it, but I mean, I don't like the way Gaston's portrayed. I feel like he's sort of a more sympathetic character for some reason, and it's unclear to me why. Also, we talked about earlier getting big names. Like, they got a big name for Belle, and she was unable to sing properly, so they had to make her voice sound unnatural.
She certainly couldn't sing like Paige O'Hara in the... animated version, and that's the kind of thing that I really don't like to see.
I think the story
only because it's like, hey, you could do better. Why aren't you doing better?
I think the story is okay, but I think it's a little bloated. Like, there's this point where they travel back to old France to like Belle's old home and find out that her mom had the plague, and it's just like, I think that's a little much. I didn't need that. I would almost prefer it be
it's a long movie. Yeah,
I'd almost prefer it be like a shot for shot remake, but also just don't make it. Like, that's the real thing. You know what I mean?
I didn't hate all the songs.
No, I didn't hate
any of the songs, if I'm being honest. I liked a few of them. It was. I mean, I listened to today the 1991 soundtrack, and
yeah,
that's just so much better even than those songs.
But on their own, those songs from the live action aren't terrible. Most of them,
and I think that's in large part because Alan Menken was heavily involved. Or involved, I don't know how heavily, but he has one or two demos of him singing versions of a song or two that he actually created for that film.
Yeah.
One of them is called Days in the Sun, which I feel like I've heard, may or may not be a sort of a tribute or him talking about his relationship with Howard Ashman. But either way, I love him singing that song. I mean, I'm sure it's great in the movie too. You like the song Evermore.
Yeah, I did like...
I like that too.
I did like that movie. Michaela hates it. Or that song.
You know, I really love that movie.
Yeah. No, I do like that. It was a Freudian slip.
Was it Freudian?
Freudian slip.
God. Mine was a Jungian slip.
Anyways.
Those are the only two psychologists I know.
Okay. So on that note... all right, guys. Well, you know, go check out those documentaries because they're quite good. And you should watch this movie too.
Well, one documentary.
One documentary and then
look out for Howard. It's just called Howard.
And then the extras, I guess, is what I mean. There's also the extra with Alan Menken.
You know what? I think there's a on YouTube currently, as of the releasing of this episode, or at least the taping of it, recording of it. There's like a maybe like a 22 to 25 minute behind the scenes thing, maybe from an earlier release on VHS or something, which has different footage than what we saw on the documentary we've referenced. So. And I have yet to finish watching that, but there's probably even more information out there. So
check it out. Yeah. There's also, if you're so inclined, an extra on the Disney Plus, which is Beauty and the Beast told through emojis. So for those of you,
oh really?
Yes. Oh yes.
I'm sure some people actually are interested in that.
Yeah, I'm not one of them personally, but maybe I'll check it out just for morbid curiosity.
Morbid curiosity?
Yes. Morbidly obese curiosity.
I'll ponder that for the rest of the night.
All of you ponder it. Reach out to us. Let us know. Anyway. All right, guys. I appreciate it. All of you listening through all of this and sticking with us. It was a lot of fun.
I don't think that was a good episode.
No, yes, but I'm babbling, so.
I told you I thought it'd be fun to talk about this movie. It was, but it's definitely more fun to watch it.
Yep, so go do that now.
Although we talk about things a lot, so it's, I guess you're trying to end it. Yeah, go watch. Go, go.
Go watch.
Wait. Listen, then watch.
Listen to this.
No.
Last few words.
Put on the subtitles while you watch. When the songs come on, pause the episode and then watch.
Yep, there you go. All right, guys. Thanks for listening. Have a good one. See you next week.
Bye-bye now.
Yep.
On what?
The Talking Llamas podcast.
Okay, bye.
Turn this off.